Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Art is a business, and you can live well from it if you're smart about it. So says Trey Anthony, one of today's three Career Buzz guests who prove it so. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of Career Cycles. We help people make career and life choices aligned with what really matters. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Welcome back to the Iron Age. When Rob Martin was growing up, he wasn't satisfied with the look of things and wanted to change them. As a teenager, he was into heavy metal and art. He went to a weekend metalworking workshop and realized he wanted to be a blacksmith. 20 years later, Rob still loves his work at Thack Ironworks. Pig farmer to the recycler, Gilbert Vanderhoevel, chose to work on a family pig farm, and in 2001, he liked pork so much he bought the company from his father. During the years working on the farm, Gilbert's metalworking skills grew, and at the same time, he became an avid cyclist. These days, well, the pig farm is closed down, and Gilbert's having fun with the next chapter in his career and life, creating new ways to use old bike parts to make functional and funky furniture. Rob Martin and Gilbert Vandenhoof will join us in the second part of today's show. But first, art is a business. Award-winning playwright, executive producer, actor, creator, and stand-up comedian Trey Anthony is known for the groundbreaking television and theatrical production Da Kink in My Hair. Critics have referred to Anthony as the Oprah of the Canadian theater scene. Anthony visits schools to inspire youth. She volunteers with the Black Queer Youth Group and speaks to students about body image and other issues facing female adolescents. Her personal call to action is featured in an inspiring TEDx Toronto video, and she's opening her new play next week in Toronto. Trey Anthony joins me live by phone from North Carolina. Welcome to Career Buzz, Trey.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do you like about your career these days, Trey?
I think I'm just really enjoying self-producing my own work, taking control of my art and my creativity, and being able to really just actualize my vision of what I feel is important in the stories that I need to tell, and to be employing others to do work that they also find inspiring and exciting and life-changing.
That's great. Now, what are you doing now? I caught you down in North Carolina, but I know you'll be back in Toronto next week. What's going on right now?
We are presenting The Kink in My Hair. We're opening, actually, tonight at the North Carolina Black Theatre Festival, and we have over 65,000 people come out to this festival each year, and so we're really excited to be presenting a main stage production of The Kink. And so we have our first show today at 3 o'clock, and we have five shows here that we're doing.
Well, that's really exciting. I hope it goes well for you this afternoon. I appreciate you taking some time out just before the big launch.
Thank you.
So on Career Buzz here, we've been talking to people about the strengths, the career strengths, the things that they use and they draw on regularly to make them successful in their careers. What are your signature strengths that you draw on to be successful?
I think for myself, it's always about doing work that I feel passionate about, and to always trust my gut and my instincts. Also, to surround myself with people who know more than myself, and to be willing to listen to those people. And I think also to know what battles to fight and what sometimes is also a compromise, and to always make sure that every single person on my team feels appreciated and that their work is rewarded, I think is also very important.
Great. Thanks for that. It sounds like a real gift to be working on a project with you. Not everybody's employer says things like that, I'm sure.
Yes.
So can you take us back and let's just see how you got here briefly and some of the key turning points in your career. How far back does your interest in theater go?
My interest in theater goes back many years. I've been in the industry for over 16 years, and I started out as, very young. And I think for me, the big turning point in my life was I kept hearing people say a lot that the whole starving artists kind of mantra that if you're going to be an artist, you're going to be starving and you couldn't make money from your art. And it was something that I just didn't feel applied to me. And I started looking at, I was just like, okay, well, there's somebody making money from art. There has to be. And I realized that those are the people who were actually making money were the people who were producing the art. And I decided then that I was going to start to produce my own work, because I realized as an actor, you probably wouldn't be making as much money. And also, even though those are the people who usually get most of the fame and glory, really where you get the most power and where you're able to have more control over your work is really as a producer. And it became, the big turning point was really at the Toronto Fringe Festival when I first produced The Kink in My Hair by myself. And I realized that I really wanted to be that person who was in charge of how the show looked, where the show would go, also how I marketed the show, and also getting an audience to come out to the show and taking some creative control over that. And I think that was a lesson that I learned, that even though the producer is the person, it's a very thankless job, to be honest with you, who has the most work on their plate, it also is financially the most rewarding position in any production. And that was when I made the decision that I was not only going to write my work, but I was also going to produce all of my work and be involved as a producer on all my projects.
So that's an amazing story and an insight that you said you got at the Toronto Fringe Festival. There may be other listeners on the show today who maybe are in theater, maybe they're actors, maybe they're directors, or thinking about producing. And what's to help people get over that threshold where they might say, oh, I can't produce my own piece of theater? That's, you know, you need way more experience or way more knowledge, or you need to be a lawyer, or you need this or you need that. What was it in the moment that made you feel confident enough to take this on?
To be honest with you, I really wasn't confident. To this day, I'm producing right now at the North Carolina Festival here, and it's a learning lesson. I think one of the things that I've always tried to remind myself is that I'm doing my best, and I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to continue to make mistakes, but I learn from my mistakes, and every single show is a new production and a new learning lesson. So there's a lot of things right now that I'm looking at and I'm saying, oh, we could have done this better for the Toronto run, or we could have done this better for the North Carolina run. But I think you have to approach producing from a level of humility to kind of say, I'm going to be humble about this and I'm going to try my best. And you also shadow a lot of people who have done it, and you ask questions, and you never think that you know all of the answers. I think one of the things I've always learned is to try and have a team that knows more than me and be willing to kind of say, you know what, I don't know. What do you suggest? But also in that, also have an ability and the belief in yourself that you can trust that there are certain things that you have to take a stand on and just say, no, this is how it's going to go, and I'm going to make this as an executive producer decision. I'm going to choose to do it this way. And I've had a lot of naysayers. I've had a lot of people who said, no, that's not the way it's been done. And sometimes I'm just like, okay, well, this is the way we are going to do it.
Yes.
Right? And in the same breath, I've also had people say, oh, well, that's not the way it has been done. And I'm like, okay, can you tell me why? Right?
Yes.
So it really is a balancing act, and you as a producer will come to learn what is the way you want to do things and how you want to develop your own shows.
So I think that's great advice, Trey, not just in theater, but anybody in their careers trying to move ahead, as many people are. And some of the things you said about, even though you're not confident, you do your best, you learn from your mistakes, you approach it from a position of humility, and you gather a good team around you. I mean, those are some really great pieces of advice for anybody in their career, not just theater. Would you agree?
I agree. I definitely agree. I think you can apply it to any business that you're trying to do, any level of self-employment, is to look at people who are doing what you're doing. Ask, one of the things that I've learned a lot is to get a really great mentor. Like, one of my mentors right now is Kevin Williams, who is the CEO of GM. It has nothing to do with theater. There's nothing creative about the job that he does, but I've learned from him just how to approach a problem, how to solve things, how to work with a team. And I think that's what I would say to people, is try and find a mentor, someone who you look up to, who you're able to bounce ideas off and to kind of see how they succeed. successfully run their own business, or have gotten to a place, a position of power that you admire and you like their work ethic. It doesn't have to be that because you're in theater, then your only mentors can be people in theater. I usually try and find people who are doing things totally opposite from me and learn from them just their work ethic of how they approach a problem.
Now you've written on your blog and elsewhere about how much you admire Oprah Winfrey. You've in fact,
yes,
been called the Oprah of the Canadian theater scene, and I know there was a little moment there that if people want to read up on your blog, they'll find the story of how you actually ran into Oprah. How did,
yes,
Oprah influence you? You know, in terms of your own career and your own confidence, you talk a lot about her, but what was the real key thing that connected you to her and helped you in your career and life?
I think for me, what really connected me to Oprah was really just, I love her sense of audacity, of just really saying, I'm going to do this, and I probably will be the first woman and the first black woman to do this in my career. And the thing that I've always watched with her is that she continues to always express the message of ownership, that you need to produce your own work, that you need to own your own product. And she has done that with her shows. And I remember watching her once talking about the advice that she got from Bill Cosby. And she said, Bill Cosby said to her, always make sure that you sign every single check in your company, that you know where your money is. And that was a message that has always stayed with me, that I always every single check that goes out within my company, I know who's getting what and how much everyone is getting paid. And she always says, too, you know what, you should own your product, never give it away to people. And so that's something that I've also decided as a businesswoman, that that's what I also want to do as well. And yes, it's a long road, and yes, it's hard, and it may be easier to get other people to do that work, but at the end of it, it does give you a sense of pride and the ability to make sure that your vision is executed the way that you want it to.
Yeah, great advice. Sign every check. I think that's
yes,
that's something that everybody can take no matter,
yes,
where they are. Now you also volunteer a lot, and it's been very interesting to talk to people on this show about how, you know, if you look at your career in the broadest context and you include volunteer activities, everything that you do is your career in a way, and you volunteered a lot. How does the volunteering work that you do help you in your career and life?
I think for me, it really is about connecting with the community and also making sure that I'm accessible, and especially to young people, especially to people of color, young girls, young women, the queer community. And I find when I volunteer, it puts me at a level of making sure that I'm one with the community and a sense of giving back. I think I have been given a lot, and one of the mantras of my life that I truly believe in, to whom much one has been given, they're required a lot to also give back. And I think I've been very blessed in my career. A lot of people have opened doors for me and helped me, and I think then I must then do the same. And so I usually really try to go out and inspire others and say it's possible. You know, I was a little young girl who grew up in Toronto housing in Rexdale with a single mom, right, who had me at age 17. So I think the odds were really stacked against me to be who I am now. And so I think if I can give that level of hope and inspiration to any other young girl who may feel that people are already writing them off right from the beginning, then I think that's my duty to do that. And so I love doing that type of work. I love motivating others. I love going out and inspiring people and trying to make sure that I open doors for them as much as doors were open for me.
Well, thank you for saying that. I think it's a real strong endorsement of volunteering and how effective that is. And sometimes you give what you most need to receive, and it really makes a difference in your life and your career. Now,
yes.
Now you've talked a little bit before about how you're a businesswoman and you've turned art into a business. Now, people are always curious about money and can it really work for me? And people are sometimes thinking maybe I should quit the day job and really pursue my passion. So can you tell us, how's the money, Trey?
I will say one of the things that people always say to me is I want to do my art full time and I want to quit my day job. I always say to people, it doesn't make sense to quit your day job right away and do your art full time. I think if there, how I started all of the time was looking at ways that I could do my art and also have some level of income coming in. So for the longest time, I chose to actually work night shifts, and I worked at a shelter for homeless women at night, and I did the night shift so then I could do my art in the day and in the afternoon. And I didn't quit my quote-unquote day job until I was able to sustain myself full-time on my art income. And so then I went from working full-time at my regular day job, then I went down to part-time, then I went down to relief, and then finally I was able to work full-time on my art. And so I think people should look at it as phases. Like, you graduate and go from different phases in your regular job with the goal in mind to eventually do your art full time. But I think it's unrealistic to think that you can just get up tomorrow and say, okay, I'm going to now do my art full time. Right? Unless you have a plan in place, or unless you have a real wealthy mom and dad.
Yes.
So I think that's how people should really approach it. On what ways? And also looking at your art as, okay, what other streams of income can you make from your art? Because I think sometimes, like, as actors, if you're an actor or if you're a writer, you're thinking, oh, well, all I can do is write on a project, or all I can do is act on the project. I think for myself, I've divided myself into very different components. Like, I'm also like, okay, I can write, I also can public speak, I can also sell a poem, I can also, produce, and so there's different streams of income that comes into me at various projects, and I think that's how you also need to divide your art and think, okay, how can I divide this? Like, okay, maybe I'm only selling a painting, but maybe I could sell bookmarks as well. Maybe I can also sell cards, and just look at how you can divide the art that you do. Maybe I could do a bit of public speaking. Maybe I can go and teach kids in the after-school program theater.
Great advice.
That's another level of income coming in. So don't just get focused on one asset of how you can make money with your art. I think break it down.
Right on. My guest today is Trey Anthony on Career Buzz here. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. Trey, just to wrap up here, and then I'm going to let you say what's coming up with your next show. But can you let listeners know, based on your personal experience and some of the twists and turns that have happened in your career and life, and the way you said, even in your own personal life, the odds seem to be stacked against you, and yet here you are. What have you learned personally about making good career and life choices?
I think the one thing that I have learned about making good career choices is just trust that you know what you know, and really to go with your gut on things, and sometimes to do things that scare you, and to take risks. I think every single opportunity that has come my way has been because I've taken a risk to do something that sometimes I'm not sure what the outcome is going to be, but I decided that that's what I wanted to do. And I think also to surround yourself, really be careful about who you surround yourself with because I think it's really important to have people who support you and believe in you, and you need to really seek those people out and surround yourself with them, right? And I think also self-care is also important as well, that sometimes it's okay to take a rest and say, you know what, I'm tired. And I always, for every failure I have, I always say, okay, I'm giving you 24 hours to cry and grieve and moan and complain about it, and then the next day you get up and you look at it and kind of say, okay, what's next? So don't get, wallowed in self-pity and doubt. So sometimes you have to just pick yourself up and go, okay, I messed that one up. What's next?
Thanks for sharing that advice. Now, if listeners want to find out more about your show, I know it's coming up on, I think, next week in Toronto. What do they need to do to find out more?
Please check out the Harbourfront Web Centre website, which is www.harbourfrontcentre.com, or you can also check out my site, which is treyanthonystudios.com. We're opening The Kink in My Hair in Toronto August the 11th at the Harbourfront Centre at the Onway Theatre. For tickets, you can call 416-973-4000, 416-973-4000, and tickets are going great, and so we really want people to come out and support. We have an amazing cast, and it's a mixture of Canadian and American cast, and it's a wonderful production, and we're really excited about it. And we're just coming back from, at that time, we'll be coming back from North Carolina after also doing the show in New York as well. And so we are really excited to be ending the tour in Toronto and bringing it back home once again. So I really need your support. So get out there, buy tickets, and spread the kink word.
Right on. Thank you, Trey Anthony, for joining us here on Career Buzz. And good luck in North Carolina and in the opening on August 11th in Toronto. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. Bye for now.
Bye. Take care.
That was Trey Anthony of Da Kink in My Hair calling or speaking to us live from North Carolina, where she has her opening at 3 p.m. later today, with some great advice about making career and life choices. And we'll be summarizing that in the Career Cycles blog about this show. And I'm going to try and get as much as I can because there was so much great advice. We're gonna move on to our next guest, Gilbert Vanderhoevel. Gilbert's father owned and ran a construction company and a pig farm. Gilbert chose to work on the farm, and in 2001, he says he liked pork so much he bought the company from his father. During the years working on the farm, Gilbert's metalworking skills grew, and at the same time, he became an avid cyclist. These days, the pig farm is closed down. Nowadays, Gilbert is having fun with the next chapter in his life, creating new ways to use old bike parts to make functional and funky furniture. Gilbert Vanderhoevel joins us live from his studio. Gilbert, are you there?
I am so. Hi.
Welcome to Career Buzz. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Gilbert, what are you liking about what's happening in your career these days?
I'm really liking the creativity in what I'm doing right now and meeting lots of new people and getting familiar with a whole new career.
And what is that new career? What are you doing?
Well, I am doing what so many other people do, making art out of bicycles. Well, maybe not so many. So I'm a cyclist and I'm a welder, and one day those two things came together and making interesting stuff from old bikes.
And when you say a cyclist and a welder, you also got this little business that you're running. What are your strengths and what are the skills that you're drawing on to make it all work right now?
I think the biggest one would be the ability or the courage just to think outside the box or not even have a box. To try something totally new and see how things go. That would probably be my biggest strength, the ability to do that. I guess imagination is another big one. And the more practical ones are knowing the bike, how to work with the bike, and the mechanical skills of welding and all that sort of stuff.
Right. Now, it's kind of a very different career than the one you came from. Now take us back. What was it like for you growing up on a family farm?
It was a big business. My father, my parents immigrated from Holland after the Second World War, and came over with a suitcase and only a few dollars and started making a life for themselves and their family. And by the time I came around, he had a construction business going, successful, working for building barns and stuff for other immigrants, and then he started a farm as well. And no one quite knows why he started this farm, but he did, and it was quite successful as well. My dad was a good businessman, understood numbers, and a great leader, and he just kind of followed his gut, his heart. And I just kind of thought that was normal. That's what people did, and that's what I've been doing with my new career. So I bought that farm in 2001. So I bought the family farm, and due to a bunch of different business issues and different things, I ended up selling it in 2010.
Let's just go back to you buying the farm. I mean, one hears, if you're like many listeners won't have that much connection to farms and farming, the idea of the family farm, we read so much about it, that the family farm is threatened. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit about how you saw that family farm and then what led up to your confidence or your belief that you could make a go of it and actually leading up to the buying of it in 2001.
Well, the family farm is a great thing. We happen to have a large, innovative family farm. We had between 10 and 15 staff at any one time, and computers that fed the pigs and kept track of the ventilation. And it was very cutting-edge technology that we adopted for our farm, particular farm. And that's more typical every year for farming. It's not the... it's not a traditional going out with rubber boots and slopping hogs anymore.
Yes.
But it's still a very key thing, for Canada, for our, you know, our local economy, that food production stays close by, stays safe, stays in control, I guess, for so you know what you're getting, because it is a basic need of life, food. And often it's really just kind of left up to the whims of the market, which is really too bad. So I did quite a bit of soul searching of leaving or of selling the farm. And one of them was, which was too bad, one of my reasons to leaving that, I didn't think society cared anymore if there was hog farms in Ontario anymore.
Yes.
Which is too bad.
Although it does seem to be experiencing a resurgence. I mean, tell us if that's true. And in a big city like Toronto, anyways, you see a lot of butchers, and they seem to be trying to communicate to consumers the linkages back to the farms, as if we're trying to reconnect to our food sources, which obviously has kind of eroded over the decades past.
Yes, there is. It's a start. It's a great start. It's going to take quite a few butchers, though, to work through the, you know, it's a large industry, just my own industry of pig farming.
Yes.
There's huge amounts of pigs, kilos of pork that go through, and just a few butchers, you know, that just, it won't save the industry, but it's a great start. The local local menus and all that thing is what we need. We need to get connected back again. And I wish I was able to connect better with consumers, but I sold to Maple Leaf.
Yes.
And it was quite hard to get past them. They were my one customer.
Uh-huh.
But I never really got to know the ultimate customer, the end consumer.
And yet, in 2001, you did decide to go ahead and buy it. Was there a moment there that sort of swung you over to that side?
To purchase it?
Yeah.
Well, it was really, since I came out of agricultural school, it was what I was going to do.
Uh-huh.
It was just this, that was the... What you did is you worked on the farm. I started the bottom of the ladder became manager of a small area, and kept growing. We had staff, so I learned how to work with people, and it's just what I did. And it's interesting when I look back at the graph on pig prices. When I bought it, was the highest in the last, say, 20 years. And that, after that exact month I bought the farm, was the highest pig price.
And then how did it actually go? You had it for a number of years, starting in 2001.
And the hog industry is a commodity, so it's like corn and gold and coffee and all that sort of stuff. It just goes by the market, the American market, and it goes up and down the big swings. And generally, it, you know, over a number of years, it all averages out. But a bunch of stuff, oversupply. American or worldwide, you know, lower prices. There's different diseases that went through Ontario and Canada that really hurt production. Canadian dollar got strong, and since we're American-based industry, that hurt us quite a bit. So a bunch of stuff happened that there were just too many low years, and we made the decision that we had to keep something of what we invested in, so we sold.
Who did you sell it to?
Other farmers. So we kind of, the farm got broken up. We had about three different properties and quite a bit of land. So the it was quite a job selling it, because it was a multi-million-dollar deal. But so it kind of got broken up into three different places, people, and actually, I don't miss it.
You don't, but it remained a farm. Is part of the story. My guest here is Gilbert Vandenhoevel, who switched from being a pig farmer to he's got a great new career building funky and functional furniture, and we're going to take a little bit of a break just here at the bottom of the hour, and then we're going to come back, Gilbert, if you can hang on with us, to find out what happened after you sold the farm. A musical break. We're going to have a song here from Douglas John Cameron from his album Solo Songs. Here's Still the Same.
To the soft, snow-covered streets and the flashing Christmas lights. Appearances often change. Don't let any new arrangements deceive you. I'm still the same. Still remember when you went across the sea. But as my time goes by, it seems so far away from me. Often change. Don't let any new arrangements deceive you. I'm still the same. Often change. Don't let any new arrangements deceive you. I'm still the same.
CIUT can now be heard on channel 946 through Rogers Digital Cable.
Like what you're hearing and want more of it? Check out our schedule at CIUT.fm. We have over 80 unique programs we're sure you'll love. We're listener supported. CIUT 89.5 FM.
We're back at Career Buzz, and I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Before moving on to continue our interview with Gilbert Vandenhoevel, I want to let listeners know about a teleworkshop, free teleworkshop, to help you become empowered in your career and life choices. For more info, check careercycles.com. The next date is Wednesday, August the 10th, 12:15 to 1 p.m. Check careercycles.com. We've been talking to Gilbert Vandenhoevel about his career change from owning and running a multi-million dollar pig farm to funky and functional furniture maker. So Gilbert, what happened when you sold the farm? We talked before the break about you leading up to that decision. What were you going to do afterwards?
Well, when I was deciding whether the farm was going to go or not, I made quite an effort not to connect what I was going to do next with that decision. I had to just make that independently, I thought, because if the farm was not a good business to keep going, but I didn't have a clear idea what I was going to do next, two couldn't be connected. I'm not saying it quite clearly enough. So I sold the farm and then decided what I was going to do next. And my hobby was making this art and furniture out of bicycles at the time. And I thought, well, that could become a job, I think. And I actually went to a bicycle school, a two-week mechanic school, and thought, well, maybe I'll start a bike shop. And, so then one thing led to another, and we put up a website, and away we went with our bike art.
So what, you know, away we went. That sounds pretty easy. I'm sure there was some ups and downs in it all. What were some of the key parts of you making a go of this? Because it sounds like it's been going now for quite a while. And in fact, when you and I met, I saw you kind of presenting your wares at the Distillery District. They had like an open event there. So how did this turn to become something really that you embraced?
The bike school I learned for to start a small town bike shop is quite a risky endeavor. You need a lot of different tools and parts to be able to service a wide array of bikes. So that was a bit of a problem. We live in a small town, only 8,000 people, and a very rural county around us. So that maybe didn't seem like the best business plan. But starting a sole proprietor business, it was really you just kind of start. There wasn't not like a corporate entity like we had before. So we started a website, which was quite important. And the name, The Recycler, was really from a web search on what we could name our website. And it actually turned out to be fairly clever with the word cycle right in it.
Yes.
And, lined up to a bunch of shows. And getting our product out there.
And how's it going now? How are you enjoying it? And how's the money?
I am enjoying it. It's still a struggle. We're just about in the middle of our second year, so we kind of had like a 3 or 4 year plan. And we got to give it a bit of time to get out there. So far our strategy has been going to arts and craft festivals and that sort of thing, getting it out there. So we've kind of switched a little bit from that to more wholesale, trying to get into other stores, that sort of thing, because we're spending quite a bit of time, long weekends, at a craft festivals. And we haven't done any actual advertising yet, which may seem weird to a lot of business starts, but we're going to start doing that at some bicycle lifestyle type of magazines. Start putting some ads in the back.
Right. Now, from all of these twists and turns, Gilbert, in your career and your life and the farm and now doing this, what can you share with listeners about what you've learned personally about making career and life choices?
I guess the big one is that we all have choices. I read that somewhere, that no matter what the situation, you always have a choice. The choice might be difficult, but we all have a choice. So I had to make a choice to keep farming or not. And many people I talked to, even they were struggling in the hog industry like I was. But they just said, no, I'm going to keep going until I can't anymore. And I didn't accept that sort of logic. They're basically not choosing. they were choosing not to choose. But, yeah, I've learned that people are artists even though they don't think they are, because I call myself an accidental artist.
Yes.
Because I never knew I was an artist until I started at this. I can't draw, so then you think you're not an artist. But there's all sorts of different forms of art. That was another big thing I've learned during the last couple of years. And there's a lot more to marketing than we first thought. We're
yes.
going to start hiring some expertise on that and get more exposure in a wider arena, not just in Ontario, which we've been focusing on now, getting our name out a little further.
Yes. Well, a really interesting story, Gilbert, the accidental artist part.
Yeah.
I really like that. So
yeah.
Thanks for joining us here on the show. Now, if listeners do want to find out a little bit more about you and find out about your funky and functional furniture, where do they go?
They can Google The Recycler. Our website is therecycler.ca. They'll find us there. Lots of pictures on our website, and they can look it up.
Great. Gilbert Vandenhoevel, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Thanks. We've been talking to Gilbert Vandenhoevel. He is the recycler and an accidental artist who used to own and run a multi-million-dollar hog farm. He's changed his career in a pretty dramatic and non-linear way. You would never guess what he would be doing next if you looked at his resume in 2009. So we're going to move on to a related interview for the final interview in today's show with Rob Martin, who is a blacksmith. When he was growing up, he says he was dissatisfied with the look of things. As a teenager, he was into heavy metal and art, and then he went to a weekend metalworking workshop. And in that workshop, he realized that he wanted to be a blacksmith. 20 years later, Rob says he still loves his work in what his company now is called Thack Ironworks. And the secret to his success is to like what you do and be persistent. Rob Martin joins us live by phone from Thack Ironworks in Floridale, Ontario. Welcome to the show, Rob.
How you doing, Mark?
Good. Thanks for joining us here. What do you like about your blacksmithing career these days?
What I like about it is 23 years into it, every day is still something new for me, and there's so many, so much unexplored territory yet to discover. So, I still love it.
And what are you doing? Like, a blacksmith is, we have ideas maybe from the movies about what a blacksmith is and does and the kinds of things they work on. What do you do?
There's a lot of misconceptions about what a blacksmith actually does. People have this whole mythology built up and a lot of historical, ideas. In this day and age, I do a lot of residential ironwork, high-end residential ironwork, things like fireplaces, door hardware, gates, railings, that sort of thing, range hoods. In addition to that, my business also does a lot of different things like we do armor rentals, we do some costuming. I also do a lot of metal sculpture and that sort of thing. So it's quite a varied business, and it keeps it very interesting for me.
You call yourself on your site not only a blacksmith, but an armorer. It's a little bit of a hard word to say, but what is the armorer part of it?
Well, when I started out my business, I was a young kid, and about 19, I started to join a reenactment group, and we were dressing up in armor and fighting with wooden swords. And I started making helmets for my fellow fighters, and that was kind of where my actual business began. And started out doing armor that way, and then I got into more advanced, more decorative, more costume, or more collectible-style armor, and kind of moved along there. And for many years, that was one of my base specialties, doing the armor work.
So let's go back to those teenage years that you just mentioned there, because this idea for your career came up out of teenagehood. I said in the intro that you were into heavy metal, but you were also into art. And
yeah.
Then what was it that clinched it, that said, gee, this idea of a blacksmith, that's interesting?
Well, I was kind of a bookworm as a teenager, did a lot of reading on both historical, real history, art, that sort of thing, as well as fantasy and science fiction and that sort of thing. And I realized very quickly that the armor and weapons that teenage boys all seem to find so fascinating was made traditionally by a blacksmith. And once I had that figured out, then I knew right then and there that's what I wanted to do. As impractical as that sounded, and my dad kind of freaked out on me as a teenager when I told him that's what I was going to do. Just did not seem like a very practical career choice.
Yes.
But I got into it before I knew any better, and the rest is kind of history.
Well, maybe that's the secret for people. Get into something before you know too much that'll dissuade you from doing it.
Yeah.
So then there was a few things still in the teenage years you were mentioning before about the recreations or those kind of shows, mm-hmm. and that's where the armor came. And so how did you get started in the armor thing?
Well, it was just, I read a few books. I talked to some people. I was in this reenactment group, and, you know, I talked to people and said, well, how would we go about making this? And I just basically started experimenting on my own. Most of it was trial and error. I was, at that time, I was working at a blacksmith shop, so I was learning the actual forging aspect, the blacksmithing aspect. But the armor is quite a different tangent of the that metalworking field. So that was something I kind of muddled through very much on my own for several years.
Now, you mentioned that you were working in a blacksmith shop. There just aren't that many of them around. There was something about a workshop that you had attended. Is that connected to the place that you were working?
Yeah, when I was in high school, my last year in high school, I discovered the Forge and Anvil Metal Studio in St. Jacobs, and I found out they were running weekend workshops. So I decided to take this course, and I spent the money and went and did the weekend, and I knew right then and there that was it. I was hooked. So I rushed home and I set up my own little forge and started hammering away, and that was that. I knew that's what I was going to do, you know, come hell or high water.
So that idea of being hooked, like, I know there'd be a lot of listeners, you know, who have experienced great moments. You know, we've gone to workshops, we've done things, and
yeah.
It's like, this is a great idea. I think I really like it. And yet, you really were hooked in a way that you made it your career, whereas other people might say, gee, that was a good idea, but maybe there's some other good ideas. What's different about you that made you stick with it?
I'm not really sure. I don't know if it's stupidity or if it's, you know, just the fact that I realized you can have anything you want in this life if you're willing to make the sacrifices to make it happen. And I was willing to make a lot of sacrifices to make this happen. I was a dreamer as a child. I had a very specific vision about what I wanted out of my life. So, you know, I came with a lot of weight behind me that I was going to make this happen. So,
and when you say you knew what you wanted in your life, even back then, what did you want? What was that picture?
Well, when I was a child, ever since I can remember, everything I've ever seen, I redesign in my mind. You know, whether it be buildings, clothing, you know, vehicles, you name it. That has always been with me, and it's something that if I didn't have an outlet for it, I would probably go insane. So ever since I was a little child, I was always working with my hands, and I was always creating things. When I discovered blacksmithing, I realized that it was a very fitting expression of my inner vision. It was something that I could really go places with, a practical application of my design that was in my head. So,
well, it's a great story of the internal connecting with the external and finding something that would be the expression for your creativity and for your longing. So I think that's an important clue, and you're telling us your story about how big that clue was and how you acted on it, and I think that's inspiring for lots of people. How was it for you then at the beginning when you said, okay, now I've experimented, I've worked in this blacksmith shop, and I want to set up on my own? How did that step happen?
That step was a 15-year painful starvation, almost. I also married very young, and we had children very young. My wife was at home with the kids, so we lived very lean for many years as I tried to, you know, get this business off the ground, a very obscure kind of business to try to get out there and get moving. So I spent years working in a factory night shift, you know, making ends meet and doing basically whatever would come through the door, whatever metal work, you know, whether it was welding, repair work, anything just to keep that business going. And it took many years, but in the last, say, 5 or 10 years, things have really kind of picked up steam, and you know, I hit critical mass, I think, about 5 years ago. Now the phone is ringing and I can't keep up with the orders.
Isn't that amazing? Like, if people are looking at you now and they say, oh, look, Rob Martin is a successful blacksmith, that only happened in the past 5 years, and there was a 15-year lead-up to make you the success that you are today.
Yeah, it's you always hear about these overnight successes, and then usually when you hear them interviewed, they all talk about that 10, 15-year of starvation, obscurity. Very rarely does the overnight success thing actually happen.
Exactly. We're talking to Rob Martin here of Thack Ironworks. He's telling us his story about becoming a blacksmith here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to explore, Rob, persistence, the notion of persistence, because those 15 years that you're mentioning that were some tough times, some lean years, you stuck with an idea that felt good or right to you, and yet there were so many other clues and problems and difficulties. How did you persist?
There was many times when we were kind of at the wall there where, financially things weren't working out, or I wasn't finding the work, I was scraping to get enough work to keep going. And I don't know, at a certain point I was too far in that I couldn't really find other employment. I didn't have appropriate skills to be able to walk into another job and be able to pay the bills anyway. So it was kind of, at a certain point, I had no plan B. So we just muddled through as best we can. But all through that, I always kept my vision about doing the stuff I wanted to do. I found a way I could make that work was by working on outrageous hours. I usually work somewhere between 60 and 70 hours a week, even now, just to keep everything flowing along. And I think a lot of people that want to get into business don't realize that the amount of hours you actually have to put in. You're not always getting paid for these hours, and you're not always able to put a dollar amount on doing certain things, but they are all necessary in the overall scheme of the picture.
So it might scare people off, but I hear you. Like, this was a commitment of time, and you mentioned sacrifice. And now, these years later, since you say 5 years ago things started to move ahead a little bit better, how have you been able to manage it? Has it helped you to cut down on your hours and to streamline your work?
It hasn't cut down the hours. I'm finding this year is probably the busiest year I've ever had, but I'm intensely reinvesting back into the business now. We're doing a lot of renovations at the shop to bring it up to another level, and my wife 3 years ago went back to college to pursue her own career, and that involved me kind of stepping up and shouldering the burden for all the bill payments again for a while, and now she has since got a job. She's designing kitchens and doing very well with that, I really haven't had any rest yet, and it doesn't seem to be any quite in sight, but I'm very excited, but with the speed of how my business is moving forward, finally, after all these years.
And bringing people on, is this you being the expert blacksmith and it has to be all your work, or are you taking on apprentices?
I've got a guy who's been with me now for 6 years, and that, again, is its own story and persistence. He kind of started very part-time. He took all the courses that I offered. I teach courses, by the way. And he just took every course, and he just kept kind of bugging me the same way I bugged Dean way back in the early years to get a job. So I got him in very part-time, and
yes.
Then over the years, he just kind of slowly wormed his way in, and now he's working full-time. It took about 4 years before he was actually really making me money, and now at this point, I've got someone who can do a lot of the stuff. A lot of the legwork allows me to do more design and the administration, that whole aspect, which I don't enjoy, but is part of the whole business thing as well. So, but that has been a huge investment on my part, and Ryan, my assistant as well. He's had to be able to tough it out to get to this point as well.
So it sounds like a real true apprenticeship in the way that we might think about it. That happened in days gone by.
Yeah, it is very old school in that respect. Like, you don't get into this for the money, and it's a definite lifestyle choice, and it's very few people that have the vision or the guts to really see it through.
And yet you did, and I was interested to hear you say a few minutes ago that there was no plan B, and that's an interesting thing. That's like closing off the exits, and if people are thinking in their own careers right now, well, I'm pursuing plan A here, but maybe I should have plan B in the background. You didn't. How did it feel not to have a plan B?
I don't recommend it. I don't recommend that people used me as a business model of how to do this, because it was a very precarious, there was no guarantees for a long time. The fact that I made it, I think, has a lot to do with my persistence and everything, but there's a lot of luck factors and a lot of things that fell into place, you know, at the very right time to make this happen. So I would not encourage people to use it as a business model, but sometimes having no plan B, you know, forces you to really make plan A work.
Yeah, I think that's the point. Sometimes not having plan B forces you to make plan A work.
Yeah.
And how is it now? How's the money? How's the lifestyle that the blacksmith work is giving you?
I wouldn't say I'm wealthy, but I'm pulling in some decent money now. I would say comparable to most people in the trades who would own their own business. I'm doing well above average.
Great.
As far as average income, but I'm certainly not becoming a millionaire anytime in the near future.
Well, congratulations for that. And finally, Rob, from the way your story has unfolded in a very unique way and quite different from many other guests we've had on the show where there's been some significant changes, yours is a story of having chosen something from a pretty young age and stuck with it through the ups and downs. What can you share with listeners about what you've learned personally about making career and life choices?
Basically, I found that mine is a little bit of a rare case in that when I was 14, I had this epiphany that I knew what I wanted, and I am still true to that vision pretty much. You know, it's been enhanced and changed and grown up a little bit, but I'm still pretty much working with that model that I developed at age 14. And most people that I've talked to over the years, they really don't figure out what they want to do when they grow up until they're in their 30s or 40s.
True.
So, I think I've been very lucky that I was able to chase that down and be true to that. But I'm also, I think, kind of lucky that my taste didn't change, that I picked the right thing for me so early on, and that it's still ringing true and resonates with me at this point.
Great, thanks. And thanks for joining us here on Career Buzz. If listeners want to find out a little bit more about you, Rob, and your work, what can they do?
Check out my website. It's probably the best place to start, and it's thak.ca, thak.ca, and that's a good starting point, and go from there.
Great. Rob Martin, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz and sharing your story.
Thanks, Mark.
You've been listening to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. You can find out more about me at careercycles.com. Two other hosts.